down and spit a rhyme right quick. Spit something so sick, you'll bob your heads in the whip. Saying his flow so thick, and I ain't trying. If I was, you would feel it, what, I ain't lying. I play flows by the dozen, sober when I'm buzzing. Whatever it takes just to get that Indian oven. That's just me and how I be when I be bunning. The Nietzsche of this nature is what the girls be loving. Now ain't that some players holler back. You know what's going down with J-Lone on the track. D-Double on the back, puffing, puffing. With no one left to pass, slowly break and take a blast. You know how we do. Nietzsche nature plays on papers when we come through. And that's how it is. You heard the flows. Nietzsche nature, you know how it goes.
And that's who I be. I'm a true Cree, and I'm living life so free. So open your eyes and realize that you can't see me. And it doesn't really matter what you know, who you are, where you're from, and who you know for a bro. Now as I spread my word like a nerd with the verbs, ain't a freak word so freely. But unfortunately you can't be me, cause I'm original Nietzsche. You can call me a Métis or a half breed Cree. It doesn't really matter to me, cause I'm showing aboriginality to reality. Cause I put the Cree and creativity. Now you're feeling me lyrically. I'm gonna represent everything, even though my Calgary resident. I feel like I'm a president in the C-spot, just giving it hot like the D-dot and my girl's D-spot, with this hip-hop going non-stop all around the world until I can't stop. And I can't quit my Nietzsche nature, cause I am the regulator of this Nietzsche nature flavor.
Language is the most powerful instrument for preserving and developing our heritage. All moves to promote the dissemination of mother tongues serve to encourage linguistic diversity and multilingual education. It develops awareness of linguistic and cultural traditions throughout the world and inspires solidarity among nations. 21st February was proclaimed as the International Mother Language Day by the General Conference of UNESCO in November 1999. This day was chosen based on its significance in the Bangla language movement of 1952. We will say a few words about the history of this language movement.
When the British left in 1947, Indian subcontinent was divided into India and Pakistan based on religion only. The two parts of Pakistan, West and East Pakistan, were two far-flung wings, separated by India, 1,000 miles apart with a lot of linguistic and cultural differences. Although Bangla was the language of the majority, Muslim League tried to establish Urdu as the lingua franca of Pakistan. On 25th February 1948, Dhirendranath Dutt, a member of parliament from East Bengal, proposed in the Constituent Assembly that Bangla be the state language of Pakistan. However, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the first Governor General of Pakistan, while on a visit to East Bengal on March 24th, declared in Dhaka University convocation,
"The state language of Pakistan is going to be Urdu and no other language."
On 31st January 1952, an all-party committee of action decided to hold a general strike on 21st February when the East Bengal Parliamentary Assembly was due to meet. February 20, 1952. An order under Section 144 prohibiting processions and meetings in Dhaka city was promulgated. This order generated tension and resentment among the students. On the next day, February 21, 1952, students of Dhaka University decided to defy Section 144, and processions were taken out to stage a demonstration in front of the Provincial Assembly. Police started lobbing tear gas shells, and riots speeded to the nearby campuses of the medical and engineering colleges. The police opened fire in front of the medical college hostel. Five persons, Muhammad Salahuddin, Abdul Jabbar, Abul Barkot, Rafiquddin Ahmed, and Abdul Salam were killed.
The news of killing spread like wildfire throughout the city, and people rushed towards the medical college premises. Thousands of men and women thronged the university area to offer prayers for the victims. After prayers, when they went for procession, the police again opened fire. Four persons were killed. Through the night of 23rd February, students of Dhaka Medical College constructed Shohid Smriti Stambho, a monument in the memory of the martyrs. In the next 48 hours, government took extreme measures by deploying military and the police. Almost all the students and political leaders associated with the language movement were arrested.
Bangla was recognized as the second official language of Pakistan on 29th February 1956. East Pakistan continued to be underrepresented in the civil and military services and received a minority of state funding and other government helps. These oppressions eventually led to the Liberation War of Bangladesh in 1971.
The Pakistani army murdered over 3 million civilians, raped over 250,000 women, and forced nearly 10 million Bangladeshis from their homes. After 9 months of bloodshed and agony, Bangladesh earned its victory in December 1971.
The language movement had a major cultural impact on Bangladeshi society. It has inspired the development and celebration of the Bangla language, literature, and culture. To commemorate this movement and the fallen ones, Shohid Minar, a solemn and symbolic sculpture, was erected in the place of the massacre by architect Hamidur Rahman. 21st February, celebrated as Language Movement Day or Shohid Dibosh, is a major national holiday in Bangladesh. Each year, on 21st February, starting from early morning, thousands of people walk barefoot to pay their respect to the martyrs at the Shohid Minar. A month-long event called the Ekushe Book Fair is held every year to commemorate the movement. Ekushe Padok, one of the highest civilian awards in Bangladesh, is awarded annually in memory of the sacrifices of the movement. Amar Bhaiyer Rokte Rangano Ekushe February, a song that represents 21st February in the heart of every Bangladeshi as it plays in every corner of Bangladesh throughout the month. It was written by Abdul Ghaffar Choudhury and composed by Altaf Mahmood.
UNESCO promotes mother tongue-based multilingual approaches in education and attempts to protect languages from extinction. In reference to this motto, responding to a proposal from Bangladesh, it declared 21st February as the International Mother Language Day. The decision was pioneered by two Canadian immigrants from Bangladesh, Rafiqul Alam and Abdus Salam. In its resolution, UNESCO said, 21st February be proclaimed International Mother Language Day throughout the world to commemorate the martyrs who sacrificed their lives on this very day in 1952.
Henceforth, countries around the world observe 21st February as the International Mother Language Day. Today, it stands as an outstanding example of national, linguistic, ethnic, and cultural pride and has been highly influential in the celebration of linguistic independence all around the world. UNESCO Director General Ms. Irina Bokova has sent us her speech for this year's celebration. This year, UNESCO has decided to explore the links between languages and books so that all people, children above all, can read in the language of their choice, including in their mother tongue. This can also boost progress towards the Education for All goals by 2015.
Tutsqueak, come on in. Welcome to CITR 101.9 FM. This is our first language-to-language program in the new year 2014. We've just been listening to a documentary on the history of International Mother Language Day. We've had many efforts by colonial powers to eradicate and destroy our languages. So it's been sort of like pushing a big rock uphill to try to regain them. People don't really realize that. I'll just read a little bit about what Dr. Wade Davis wrote for a Haida publication called, it's Haida Language, That Which Makes Us Haida. He said a language is not just a set of grammatical rules or vocabulary. It does not exist merely to permit communication. To the contrary, every language is a flash of the human spirit, the vehicle by which the soul of a particular culture comes into the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of social, spiritual, and psychological possibilities. Each is a window into a universe, a monument to the specific culture that gave it birth and whose spirit it expresses. His quote goes on to say a lot more than that, but I think that should suffice just to give you an idea that these aren't just meaningless blasts of air forever forgotten. The difference between a written language and the spoken is written language, once it's written down, is chiseled in stone and it can't change. It has no flexibility except to the people who want to make it say what it does. In fact, that is really what a lawyer does. A lawyer plays on the imperfections, I'll put it that way, of the English language and other languages, the ambiguities, because facts don't speak for themselves. They say what you want them to say. But when you're actually speaking the language and you're speaking to another human being, there's a lot more interplay that goes into it because a lot of it's nonverbal. It's things that you have to learn to watch for. So anyway, today we're very, very honored to have a special guest with us today. Oh, and also Gunarji's here. I forgot about you. Gee, it's easy to forget you here.
You don't want to forget about Gunarji. Yeah, I'm your operator.
Yeah, you might throw the wrong switch or the wrong knob.
And I could turn you off or I can turn you on. It's up to you.
So anyway, we do have a special guest today that I guess you might say was involved with this International Mother Tongue Day. He was born in Bangladesh. He grew up there. He was educated there, went to university, came to Canada, and spent 25 years working with First Nations in community development and a few other things that we'll discuss as we go along. So with that, I want to welcome... Oh, I'm terrible when it comes to pronouncing names. It's Mr. Rabul Alam, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm known as Rabi Alam.
Rabi
Alam, yeah. Welcome to the program.
In the First Nations circle.
Yeah, so maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the history of how this developed, this Mother Tongue Day.
Okay, I want to thank you first to invite me to this talk show. I think it's an honor to be able to come and share where I come from and the language issues of the country that we had to grow up with. When you gave introduction, your feature in a talk about how India was divided and then and what was known at the time Pakistan and East Pakistan. I was born in 1941, and I was born in a country at that time called India. And the area I was born, the language was Bengali, called Bengali, and the province was known as Bengal. So the province was divided based on the religious line. And what they did, I think they did in a hurry. The British Empire, they were withdrawing in a very hurry after the Second World War. So they didn't spend enough time to figure out the people, where they live, the language, the family structure, nothing. Just in a hurry, religion, and then draw a line on the map, and then they left. That left the whole continent into a real strife and civil war. And during the partition of India, about 6 million people died on the civil war based on religious division and the boundaries, the way they are drawn. When I was four, my parents lived in Calcutta, that's now in India. So our place was burned down. So if you have seen Gandhi movie,
yes.
In the Gandhi movie, you will see the riots in Calcutta. And right during the time of riot, I was four and I was in Calcutta. And I remember my parents and myself, we just left with a bundle of clothes on our back and we walked all night for days to come to what is known as East Pakistan. So we came, we settled, we thought we'll be okay. But our language was Bengali. But within years, you know, India was divided. One was East Pakistan, the other was West Pakistan. East Pakistan language was Bengali. West Pakistan, the language was Urdu. And you have heard, you know, the leader of the Pakistan at the time, he came and he declared that language will be the Urdu, state language. And I remember I was in school, and all of a sudden, all our education curriculum was introduced in Urdu, and I had to learn Urdu. But luckily, we were a big, you know, province with a massive amount of population. So we decided we are not going to give up our mother tongue, and we, and Bengali is going to be the state language, one of the state languages. The two languages, like here in Canada, you have French and English. French people had the French language, and English people, the English language. But what was lost here is the First Nations language, because there was nobody to fight and stand up to retain the language. I'll come down to that later.
Okay.
What happened you know, you have heard 1952 that when police started firing on the university students and about 8 people died. At that time, I was 11 years old, and I remember coming out from the school in the streets and shouting that we want our mother tongue. So anyway, after that sequence of events went on, and after 8 people died, it really caught fire among all people. Suddenly they realized, my gosh, we had 200 years of British rule. Britain didn't try to take our language away. All of a sudden, this new group of people, they want to take our language away. So that rallied people. And that language rally eventually became a rally for the people to win people's freedom. That means we as people, we want to have our freedom. At that time, people were not fighting for independence of a country. They are trying to establish our language, our rights, democratic rights and equality. And from there on, hesitation continued for years. And I remember I finished school, came to college, came to university, and at that time, I played, as university student, quite a significant role along with the leader who was the founder of the nation. I had a lot of dealings, and I have pictures with him. Also, I had some dealings with the person you'll see in the Gandhi movie, chief minister at the time of Bengal. Mm-hmm. I have also known him. But anyway, I left country after finished university, went to England to do the university studies. But all my friends, they carried on. And that led year by year, year after year, the country's rulers, they did not recognize the strength of the people, the moral strength of the people. They didn't have any arms. They're rural people, like here the First Nations people, you know, years ago. But they were so united and strong. They came to the state. They fought against the army with sticks and bamboos and hands. And in the end, you know, army was defeated and they left the country. So the language movement led into freeing people into freeing the whole country. So that's how the independent country came into existence.
Well, that history, I was born the same year, 1941. And I do remember, it was, I think, the Vietnamese, Viet Minh, that attacked the French to chase them out of Vietnam in that late 1940s. And then around the same time, 1950 or so, the North Koreans invaded the South. And so we had a war going on there. And I do remember hearing the terrible things that were going on in, which was later, I guess, Bangladesh. But it seems like wherever the British went, they drew their own boundaries, they put down the names of countries, and then they left it in chaos. And that's what they did to us here. The Russians and the British were going to be going into war, I guess, in the Crimea. And they didn't want the war to interfere with business. So they were racing to see who could gain control of what now is Alaska, the southern part. So the British, the Northwest, was it a trading company, something like that, were racing to get down the Stikine River to get to what today is Wrangell. But the Russians got there first. And so they just arbitrarily drew a line at 56 degrees, 30 minutes north, something like that, 54-40. And so south of the line was English, north of the line was Russian. And they didn't ask who was there. And we Haidas, the northern Haidas, were on the Alaska side, mm-hmm. whereas the Canadian are on this side of the line. And when Canada started the residential schools, and they came up with this whole notion of status, we were not looked upon as status. So if a Canadian Haida woman married a Alaskan Haida man, she lost her status because she'd married a white man. So all these things start coming out of it. And this, I remember that movie, Gandhi, about what was taking place in Pakistan. It wasn't only language, but you had Hindus and Muslims.
And the Sikhs.
And the Sikhs all fighting each other. But to me, this was all a result of colonialism, because all of the values that they've gotten from the British Empire became the ruling principles of whatever countries these were in. So when you talk about how the fight to save your language really gave rise to a movement of freedom, because they can take everything away from you, but if you have your language, they haven't conquered you.
Yep.
Because they can't take your mind.
Yeah, this reminds me when I started with the First Nations communities, I have something in common right away. Something in common in the sense, as you mentioned, in the oral history. My grandfather, he didn't go to school. But when I was 4 or 5 years old, he used to tell me all kinds of stories. When I went to university, I started reading those stories in the book. And I was amazed, how did he learn all these things? And here I am in the university, I'm learning these. Mm-hmm. So when I came here to Canada and started with the First Nations, and it took me at least 5 years before they could trust me. Because here, the First Nations people, they have seen so many people come in, all the do-gooders.
Yeah.
And then they leave, and they say one thing, and they leave, and they do another thing.
When you say when you started with the First Nations, in what capacity were you working with First Nations people?
I started as a community planner.
Okay.
And that led me to go to the community and work with them. But as a regional planner for the whole Saskatchewan province at the time, I developed my approach that I'm not going to prepare a plan sitting in the office because I had university qualification, I could do that. My whole idea was that I'm going to go to the community. I'm going to spend time and figure out about the community, mm-hmm. what the community is all about,
yeah.
what kind of lifestyle they have, and how they want to proceed with their future lifestyle and put together a plan with them. And that's how.
Wow. And so what did you find? What kind of a lifestyle was going on at that time?
It was a shock at the start.
Uh-huh.
But then I have to overcome the shock, you know, the way people are living. Like, I travel to north in the communities. I've seen, you know, the kids playing outside in minus 20 temperature. And their homes, the windows, homes had no insulation. Windows had no window. It's a plastic mm-hmm. cover in the window.
Mm-hmm.
And in the houses, you know, 5-6 people living in that one-room house.
Yeah.
But they were surviving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I saw they are surviving, then I thought, if people can survive in this kind of situation, they will survive
anything.
Yeah, they will survive anything. That's the confidence it really gave me. You know, if I have learned one thing about how to survive, that's what the first lesson I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that came out of, well, in Alaska, where I'm from, one of the problems that was very prevalent was an ear infection called otitis media. And so many of our young people ended up deaf because of that infection, and they couldn't get any medical treatment. And I assume the same thing was happening here. And then when I was growing up, there was a lot of tuberculosis. And what they did was they'd ship people off to a sanitarium someplace and usually never saw them again. They'd send them off somewhere else to die. And then when I was in high school, I was in grade 12, they tested some pills on us. One half of the students took type A and the others took type B. And then at the end of the school year, they checked to see how many got tuberculosis. And I was in a group that didn't have any, and the other group had tuberculosis. So they used us for medical experiments.
Yes. Coming back to another point, that what did I see in whatever I learned? I mentioned, you know, first thing, how I went to learn. Second thing, I saw most of the people are speaking English, but the older people, they are not speaking English. Mm-hmm. And that sort of made me curious to, you know, what happened. And that's the time I began to learn from the chiefs that they lost the language. And there are a number of chiefs from Saskatchewan, they became my personal friend. You know, mm-hmm. And they have been in the residential school too. So the story I was told that when they came out of residential school, you know, they couldn't connect with their parents because they lost the language. Mm-hmm. But parents still kept the language, and they still started, you know, they were not allowed to let it go. They were trying to sort of, you know, pass on the language, you know, as much as they can. And some of my friends of my age group, First Nations friends, you know, when they had the first child, they sent the child to the reserve to learn from the grandparents some of the language, although they're living in the city. Mm-hmm. When I found that, then I thought, yes, you know, although people are living in the city with the English language and everything, but inside them, you know, they are not letting it die. Mm. So they are letting the children learn few things and basics of the language and bit of oral history. So coming back to the thing that if you have strong belief and language is in your blood, people can't wipe it out. They can wipe out a generation. They can wipe out second generation. Somehow, it comes back. It's like DNA. People can be dead for 500 years, and you go to the bone and take the sample, and you find who this person is. Oh. So it's the language. Mm-hmm. You know, on the surface, it may seem it's dying.
Yeah.
But you never know. Your next generation, they may find ways to bring it back.
Yeah, we had another show over at Co-op Radio. Remember when we were talking to some people who had actually lost their language and years later picked it up as if they had... Oh, it was yesterday's show on Snow Whales. A lady, Barb Harris, was talking about how one of the students came into her course, had lost the language and came back. She lost it because she married a Cree, right, uh-huh. from Saskatchewan. And 20 or 30 years later decided that she wanted to reconnect with her own culture and came to her language lesson classes. And pretty soon, within a year, she was speaking fluently.
Yes.
So she didn't really lose it. It's always in the blood.
It's in the blood, exactly.
See, there's some of us. I have a niece that's like that. You know, some of us just never let it go. I was 13 when I got sent away to residential school, but up until then, these old men were teaching me in the Haida language, but it was against the law. So if I told anybody, they might go to jail. So I had to carry this secret that I understood the language and I could speak to them, I could, you know, whatever. And then I got sent away to school, and I was so angry at everything and everybody, I pretty well forgot everything. And then when I was in law school, I got sort of tricked into going into a sweat lodge ceremony. And while I was in there, I saw what had happened to me, what I had become. And I was so angry, I just said, let me out of here. I pushed my way out. I didn't want anything to do with that crazy man. And about 2 weeks later, they got me in there again. And this time I thought, no, I'm going to face me this time. And I had a real hard time. But all of a sudden, all that stuff from all those years, it just swamped me. I couldn't hardly breathe. It was so intense. And then gradually I started sorting my way through it again. And I got home, and most of my teachers were gone, because in the 1940s, some of them were already over 100 years old. And none of them had been Christianized, and they hadn't been to any kind of residential school. So they were giving me the information before it was adulterated with that colonial speak. And so now, even though I don't speak the language, if somebody gives me a phrase and gives me an indication of what they're talking about, I can see it. It's not that I remember, I see it. It's very visual. I can see all those images.
It's amazing. You are telling me, how you got purified through the sweat lodge. When I was negotiating a claim in Alberta, I had my staff doing historic research from archives. And a lot of archival information is still secret.
That's what I keep telling. Yeah. Go to the archives.
Yeah. Government won't let it go public. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of the archival information came out that really struck me. In the early days, when the settlers moving into the remote areas, the two people, three people moved in. One is the fur trade, Hudson's Bay people, mm-hmm. looking for furs. Second one is the church, and third one is the RCMP. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So these three moving along as a group. Mm-hmm. And then they will establish a post. A post will be the fur people bring in furs to sell, and the RCMP will be protecting, and church will be doing the conversion work. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one story. The church has the medicine. So anytime children feel sick, this and that, they will treat, but on condition that they will be baptized. Uh-huh. One family, the father, he refused to baptize the kids. And this is from the record, church record, I'm mm-hmm. saying. And then he had to go for hunting and gathering food. So he'll go away for days. So his wife was getting desperate. The child was getting sick. So father came back and took again and begged to get some medicine. And the church's position was that, no, you have to baptize. If you don't, we won't let the child die. RCMP will take the child away. So the parents, they took the child and ran into the forest. Didn't want to baptize. And according to the record, the family never came back. And mm-hmm. they don't know what happened to the family. So, the inner strength and their self-belief was so strong that the family took that step. And I had nightmare after reading that for a few nights, I couldn't sleep.
They took their lives into their own hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the comments I wanted to make about the language being in our DNA, like one of the things that I experienced, Woody, when I do get to use my own language by whatever means, is that it does two things to me. It allows me to tap into my inner child. I feel like really, really like young. And I feel my child learning something. And the other thing that it does is it allows me to tap into my ancestors. I can create, as an actor, and with the use of language, it can help me to develop my own character, my old me, my young me, my middle-aged me, my mom me, my grandma me, all of me. That's what I love about the language.
Yeah, it defines you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it defines you as a person, your personality, And you as a whole person, as you are saying,
yeah.
you know, you can relate to who you are, where you come from,
yeah.
your children, your grandparents, sort mm-hmm. of past with the future.
Yeah.
And that makes you a whole person.
Yeah, the real me.
The real meaning, yeah.
Did you ever meet a man named Raven Mackinaw?
I've heard about him.
I used to work with him. My former wife was teaching at Calgary University, but before that we were in Lethbridge, so I got to know Leroy Little Bear fairly well because we were together all the time. And so through him I met Albert Lightning and Johnny Sampson and Dan McLean and some of these elders. And I would ask him questions like this about, well, one man there, I think his name was Goodstriker, and his hair was cut short. I asked him, you ever let your hair grow long? And he said, yes. I said, what, you didn't like it? And he said, no, I would get terrible headaches because they so indoctrinated me that I hated my hair. You know, and they would tell me things like mm-hmm. that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Poundmaker up there at Edmonton, the alcohol treatment center up there for codependency. So I got a chance to meet many of those elders there in Edmonton. I was working for the Indian Association of Alberta, and I used to work with the Elder Senate. So that language, you know, some of those people just take off out into the bush, their trap lines. And they didn't care what they took with them. Seemed like they were strong enough to survive no matter what happened.
Yeah. Yes, yes. When we sort of, you know, in Bangladesh now, you know, this language thing, 21st February, you know, is celebrated as a Martyrs' Day.
Is that from the word Bengal?
Yeah, Bengal, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the Bangladesh is the translation from Bengal. That means Bengali's country. Is Bangladesh. Desh is the country.
Okay.
Yeah, and Bangla is the Bengal. But anyway, what I tell them, because I'm only a few survivors sort of, you know, right from the beginning up to now, I tell them, look, the people, those who fought to survive the language, mm-hmm. they did their job.
Yeah.
You know, don't spend all your time crying and getting emotional that they saved our language. The language is there, you are enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you going to do to enrich it? And what language means? If language is the human expression, then human expression comes through a number of ways. Language is the sound. Then human expression, you know, if you are mute, you're using sign language.
Mm-hmm.
But still it's a language. If you're expressing yourself, you know, outside the sound, you want to leave something permanently, you are putting it in carvings. That's also your language. Uh-huh. You're expressing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You are doing painting on paper. That's also expressing, you know, it's becoming an art. But it's the human expression. So human expression comes in many forms. And the sound is the language. Sign is another language. Your art, your craft, they're all human expression and they're translation of your emotion, your expression, your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming out.
Yeah, I work with Mike Dansley. He's Niska and he has a program called Indigenous Roots Art Mentoring. And last night was our first session for the next 14 weeks. And what we tell the students is that there are certain things you need to know. First, we talk about commitment. We talk about loyalty. We talk about courage and honesty and all those things. Because when you begin a project, you begin with a story. You put a story into that. And whatever, however you are inside, that's what's going to show up because, like you said, that's an expression of who you are. And it also is an expression of who you're becoming. And if there's a flaw inside you, it'll show up there. So instead of trying to change that into a perfect line, go and find the flaw and fix that one. So whether you're weaving, painting, drawing, carving, or telling stories.
Keep expressing.
Yeah.
Keep expressing. Yeah, yeah. And then your flaws will come out, your finer element will come out, and over a period of time, flaws will be left out because you know where the flaw was, and then you keep making progress. And if your expression through, you know, art, craft, your totem poles, if it goes on, that means your language is surviving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's what Mike D'Angeli, too, their family has a victory song that we sing it. And what it is we're taunting our enemies and laughing at them because we survived. We not only survived, we're thriving.
Yep.
We're re-speaking our languages. We're singing our songs, dancing our dances, doing our art. We survived, so we won.
Yeah, exactly. I keep telling my children when they're young and now they're adults.
Taller than you.
Yeah, taller than me. it's the weather.
Yeah. That BC weather.
What I have learned, you know, traveling in the north of Canada, the First Nations,
mm-hmm.
you know, I kept asking questions, you know, why do you talk so much about the ravens? And what I've heard from the people, those who still live off, you know, hunting and, you know, gathering things, I'm told that ravens were the frontline guide. When you are out, it's a vast land, it's unknown, you know, all kinds of flaws, enemies, attacks. But raven guides you and gives you warning. What's there? So they're the best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they sort of respect the raven in a kind of thing. So you had in your culture, you know, you learn to communicate not through your language, but there must be some kind of communication with the wild animals that they're serving you as your guide, you know, to relate, you know, to the hostile environment and leading you to do your things, you know, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you're listening here to CITR 101.9 FM. And we're talking with
Ruby.
Rabbi.
Okay. I say Ruby, you say Rabbi. No, I say again.
Rabbi. R-A-B-I.
R-A-B-I alum.
Yeah.
We're talking about language, and we started off with listening to a documentary on the history of the International Mother Language Day that's coming up in February, is it?
February 21st.
February 21st.
Yeah. Well, how did that come about?
Okay, what happened? You know, we had our language secured and we became an independent country. Then, you know, one or two people, they came to Canada about 17 years ago. And they did in the 71, they were the fighters, you know, they took up arms and they fought. So they came here and they thought, they learned, you know, what happened to Canadian First Nations people. They lost their language.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started learning about, you know, other countries. So they thought, how about approaching UNESCO and lobbying to declare an International Language Day and use February 21st because, you know, there, you know, that led into birth of a country, you know. So they did some work, put together material, and then they lobbied Bangladesh, Pakistan, and few countries because UNESCO would not act based on requests from individuals. It has to be from the country,
mm-hmm.
because UNESCO is the embodiment of all the world's countries. So Bangladesh and Pakistan, a few countries, they liked the idea. They thought it makes sense. It's a historic, you know, thing. And they also recognized that what's happening around the world about the languages. So they petitioned to UNESCO to declare February 21st, International Mother Language Day. And it had to go to the whole body of the United Nations, a secure majority vote. And 195 countries, you know, majority voted for it. So that's how it became International Mother Language Day.
So on that day, we will have you on the show for that one, so we can talk more about it. But looks like we've almost used up our time
already.
Yeah,
we have almost done that. But one question I did have is, how did the architect Rafi Gull fit into the National International Mother Language Day?
Rafik.
Yeah, Rafik.
Yeah, Rafik and Salam, these are the two people.
Oh,
I mentioned they came to Canada 17 years ago.
Yeah.
They're the ones, you know, came up with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some research about international, what's happening in different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And they put together material and they approached the government of Bangladesh, government of Pakistan, and other, you know, governments. And their job was to convince these governments and get the support and push them to apply. And that's the role they played.
Uh-huh.
You know, without their ideas and push, likely the governments wouldn't have done anything. So that's why they are.
Wow. It's been great talking with you, and welcome to the collective of Language to Language, Woody Morrison and Mr. Alam. We'll be back next week with Language to Language. In the meantime, we got A Tribe Called Red. Thank you for listening to us.
Thank you very much.
Canada, I am your queen. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Splendid.